If everyone would please take their seats. The clock in the back says 1 o'clock, and Speaker Ben says we always have to start on time and end on time. This is a meeting of the Triumph Gulf Coast Board of Directors. We welcome all of you here, and I would ask our Executive Director, Susan Skelton, to call the roll, please.
Mr. Bentz?
Here.
Mr. Connolly?
Here.
Dr. Dana?
Here.
Chair Gates?
Here.
Mr. Lee?
Here.
Mr. Riggs?
Here.
Mr. Schoaf?
Here.
Quorum present, Mr. Chair.
Quorum being present, the Board of Directors is called to order. We appreciate everyone being here. At least it's a good way to get in out of the rain. And we thank our friends and our hosts, the County Commission of Santa Rosa County, for allowing us to be here today. We are pleased to have the Vice Chair of the County Commission, Sam Parker, who's here. And Mr. Vice Chair, thanks again for your hospitality, and the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, board members, for coming. We do extend our welcome wholeheartedly from Santa Rosa County and appreciate you coming here today. As you know, Santa Rosa County is not only one of the top 10 fastest growing counties in the state of Florida, but we're also one of the top 5 fastest growing counties in the nation. Our school system is repeatedly ranked in the top 10 of of the state of Florida by almost every metric year after year. We're proud to be home of Pensacola Whiting Field NAS, where we actually have more touch and goes than any other naval air station in the country, and I believe even exceed Atlanta. We are growing. We are investing in not only site preparations by getting certified, but actively working to build Santa Rosa County to be a better place for businesses to relocate and flourish. We're excited to see what's going to come out of the ideas and projects that will flow through your board, and please let myself know or any of my staff members know if there's anything we can do to assist you. And again, we welcome you to Santa Rosa County.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. It's good to be here. Do any members of the board have any opening comments? Any board members? If not, let's go to the review of the January 29th meeting minutes. Those minutes have been posted. They've been before you for review. Are there any comments or corrections? If not, a motion is in order to approve those minutes.
So move.
Speaker Benz moves. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Connolly. Is there discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
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 Adopted. Let's now go to our executive director's report. Susan Skelton, you're recognized, Susan.
Good afternoon, members. The first item is the phone system, and our phone system is going live today. If any of you have called me, you may have had trouble getting through. The phone number that has been the phone number for 2.5 years is going to continue to be our phone number, and it's a number that you will be able to give out as your phone number once we get you registered and online. And that number is 850-387-9405. When you dial that number, you'll be prompted to dial your party's extension, and your call will go directly to the cell phone of the person you wish to contact after all the phones are programmed. Your personal cell phone number will not show up on the caller ID. Rather, the Triumph Gulf Coast number will be displayed. You'll be able to dial out through the TGC number from your personal phone, and the person you are calling will see the Triumph Gulf Coast number on his or her caller ID. Each member will need to register their cell phone number and download an app to activate the extension, and staff will be working with each of you to get your phones registered and activated in the next few days. That's the phone system report. On the six-month review of the agreement with our legal staff, Chair Gates and I met with Mr. Remington on behalf of Clark Partington on March the 5th to conduct a six-month review of our letter of engagement with the law firm. We all agreed that the initial workload was substantially greater than anticipated, but that it should be leveling off with the addition of new staff and the development of our work processes going forward. I reported to Senator Gates that the working relationship had been very positive to date, and that the only concern had been an occasional need for a more timely response due to the model whereby all issues are funneled through Mr. Remington. As the managing partner of a busy firm, he is not always immediately available for response, and Mr. Remington agreed and he'll be providing us with subject experts on his team related to business or tax issues so that we can talk to those attorneys directly. And he told us that Ms. Billheimer and his assistant, Cecily Blackledge, would be his backup contacts for all issues that are not delegated. And since that review, I've been satisfied with the arrangement, and we will be able to move forward with that. And it appears to be a working out the kinks in our business process and not a major problem. So with that, that was my comment on the six-month review, Mr. Chair.
That's one side of the relationship. Mr. Remington, how are we to work with? Be careful with your comments.
You've been a joy to work with. We've really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Go ahead.
To address Susan's concern about making sure that you always have access to somebody on your desk as part of your package is just a contact card. So if I'm not immediately available, feel free to call anybody on this list within the firm who is familiar with the Triumph process. And if they can't answer your question, they will get you in touch with somebody who can.
Are there any questions about our legal services relationship? Any questions? If not, let's move to the finance report. Stephen Riggs. Mr. Riggs.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In front of you...
You may want to press the speak button. There you go.
Okay. In front of you, you'll have two sets of financial statements from Tipton Marler. We'll just go ahead and look at February's because it's a year to date. Again, on our on page two, again, is our balance sheet. Again, we have roughly $300 million in cash. But, you know, every month we have a liability that we show that because we have to transfer money to the DEO. So we show that we earned, there's an interest payable to the trust of around $411,000. So we show that payable there. On page three, again, for February and year-to-date, you'll see in February we expended around $50,000, and year-to-date we've expended around $84,000. There's nothing material or abnormal about this. This is pretty consistent with what we've seen on a month-to-month basis. Again, with us adding our legal services and our and Susan and Corey and Dr. Rick Harper, these are just our normal monthly reoccurring expenditures.
Are there questions on the January financials?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Connolly.
Thank you. Steve, is February what you would expect to be now a typical month on expenses short of us adding any additional staff?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Let's take these because we need two motions. First, as to the January report, are there any further questions? If not, a motion is in order to approve the January financial report.
So moved.
Moved by Mr. Connolly. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Dr. Dana. Are there questions? Is there debate? Is there objection? If not, show it adopted. We're on the February financial report. Any further comments, Mr. Riggs?
No.
Any questions on the February financials? Any questions? Motion's in order to adopt or approve the February financials. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Moved by Mr. Lee. Is there a second? Seconded by Mr. Schulf. Is there discussion? Is there debate? Are there questions? Is there objection? If not, show it adopted. Before we move on, I did want to mention that in the last legislative session, thanks to the good work of President Joe Negron and Speaker Richard Corcoran, we were able to get a glitch in our financial machinations fixed. As Mr. Riggs has pointed out, in the amendments that were done in the last session, not the ones just ended, but the previous session, there was a glitch whereby the interest earned on our funds was deposited back into the DEO's trust account. But thanks to the President, Speaker, and our Northwest Florida legislative delegation, whom we're very grateful to, there was a change made in the back of the General Appropriations Act so that those interest dollars go into the trust fund but then are returned to Triumph Gulf Coast. And, Mr. Speaker, I know that's an issue that you were concerned about and you recognize, sir.
It is. And, Mr. Chairman, take full credit. You ran that. You got with all the folks that needed to be talked to, and you did a great job. And that's about $3 million. About $3 million for Triumph. So take a bow, Mr. Chairman.
Now, that was your idea, sir. We're just, and Mr. Connolly and others were involved in that with their influence with the legislature and with the governor's office. So it was a glitch. It was not a big deal to fix it, but we got it fixed. And as Speaker Vance points out, that simply means that the interest we earn on the money that we have is interest money that we can deploy for economic transformation in Northwest Florida. It's not sitting in a trust fund in Tallahassee. And our treasurer will be working out with DEO the machinery by which the money is deposited in their trust account and then comes back out.
Okay, great.
Any questions on that? If not, I think the next report from our treasurer has to do with our banking process for awards payments, and Mr. Riggs, you're recognized.
All right, thank you.
Okay. We've run into a situation where because of our funds being essentially state funds, but our funds have to be deposited in a qualified public depository account with a financial institution. This money has certain restrictions on it. Banks have certain capital requirements on it. And long story short, if we are going to take money from our trust fund account and deposit into our bank account, so let's say we were going to expend $10 million. So we would have to transfer money from our trust fund over to our checking account so we could eventually wire money out. But because there are restrictions on that money, the bank cannot hold that money themselves. Okay? So what is going to end up having to happen is they are going to take that money and they are going to spread it out amongst various different banks. And there's a couple different programs involved, but they do it below the FDIC insured amount of $250,000. So this money will get, once we deposit in their account, within a day, it will be reallocated to various banks for them to hold. Okay? And we'll earn some minimal amount of interest. And because of that, I'll also tell you, once we need the money, a week later it comes back into our account and we wire it immediately out, okay? But because of that, we may run into some potential conflicts if our bank were to put monies in banks that board members may have a conflict with, okay? So we have asked for each board member to provide financial institutions that you may have a conflict with so we can have an exclusion list of where this money gets spread out to. So, Susan, I don't know, do you have that list in front of you or do we?
Mr. Chair, our CPAs have it. I believe Mr. Remington had polled members about their need to be excluded, and I believe we have the list here.
Why don't we read out the list of banks
Yes, sir.
That we will not be using as depositories because members of this board have shareholder or director relationships
okay.
with those banks.
Yes, sir. The first one is the Mercantile Bank of North America. Dr. Dana has a conflict. Capital City Bank Group, Mr. Connolly and Mr. Bentz have a conflict. First Florida Bank, Mr. Gates has a conflict. And Hancock Whitney, Mr. Lee has a conflict. And those are the ones that we're aware of at this point.
All right. If any other members have shareholder relationships or director or officer relationships with any other bank, please let our legal counsel know. That list of banks with which we have conflicts because of board member membership on those bank boards or in their shareholder groups will be posted on our website. And so anybody in the public who wants to know who we're not going to do business with, we'll have that opportunity to see it. Are there any other comments on that issue?
No, I'll just let you know, once we compile that list, we will provide that to our bank, and then they will ensure that they are on the exclusion list, and the funds will not be deposited with those institutions.
Are there any questions about this from any member? Just so members of the audience may know, and we're being followed today on the Florida Channel, we're delighted to have them here, and any of you who speak today, you can be famous statewide. Just a comment, we have been very, very careful in the crafting of the original legislation, the work that Speaker Benz has done in advising everybody about this process, through the legislature to make sure that we follow every single ethical standard that is in current law, and in fact, we have higher ethical standards and conflict of interest prohibitions as to Triumph Gulf Coast than exist, as far as I know, in any state agency. And so this is simply an example. If any of us have a relationship with the bank, that bank will not be able to be used as a depository for any funds. That's what we just went through. Any other questions or comments about that? If not, Mr. Riggs, you're on to chat about contract and performance measurement processes for successful applicants.
If I could back up to one other item sort of related to our banking process, the wire transfer signature approval process.
Sure.
Okay. We're going to need a motion in order to have our current signatories on the bank account be the persons involved and associated with our wire transfer from our bank to an awardee. So my motion is going to include having two signatories for substantial wire transfers from our bank. So right now we have things really locked down with Florida Prime on who can and who cannot have, you know, transfer money out and where it can go. We're just wanting to extend that to our current bank, so when we do award funds, we will need two signatures on a wire transfer authorization form, and then they will also do a phone call verbal confirmation before that wire goes out.
And is that, what is the, what's the amount above, below?
Susan, do you remember the amount?
Our current minimum or maximum is $10,000 for one signature. Anything above $10,000 requires two signatures.
All right. So is that your motion that any wire transfer that is at or above $10,000 requires the signature or approval of two of the signatories?
Correct.
All right. And who are those signatories for the record?
Myself, you, and Mr. Benz.
Okay. Are there any questions? Is there any objection? If not, show it adopted as presented. And now, Mr. Riggs, please move on.
All right. To the contract and performance measurement process for a successful applicant. We had a workshop meeting discussing this issue, and really it came down to there's going to be some sort of monitoring process associated with once we award an applicant funds, or prior to them getting funds, there's going to be some performance measures that are going to need to be met. So I don't have a motion on this. It's just kind of talking general about this process. But once we enter into negotiations with an applicant, we are going to then at that time develop certain performance metrics associated with that applicant. And depending on the complexity of the things that they will have to meet, we may get some additional help to help validate whether those performance metrics are met. But I've heard the board discuss many times ensuring that if we are going to expend funds, that what we're expending funds, the money's going towards that. And if there were certain benchmarks or milestones that are needed within the performance of that applicant, that we want to ensure that that applicant meets those metrics. So we did not come up with a formal policy for like a one-size-fits-all, but we are going to, once we enter into negotiations with that applicant, tailor those performance metrics to that applicant. Because some, you know, you may have a process that, or an applicant that has a project that's very simple. It may not need a lot of detail in it, and then we have some that may be very complicated. So that's why we didn't feel like a one-size-fit-all. But we just want to let the board know that once we do enter into negotiations with the applicant, we will come up with some performance metrics to help monitor that application and ensure our funds are spent in the manner that they were intended to.
Are there questions or comments? Mr. Connolly.
I think this is a very important point for us to all keep our mind on. I would just also add that we shouldn't reinvent the wheel here either. As our state and other, even regional, I go back to the IRF process we had several years ago, there were provisions in those contracts that I think address something very similar to what we're talking about. We ought to just tap into the experience we've had here locally and at the state level and us not recreate the wheel, so to speak.
Well, and we have the advantage of having Dr. Dana on our board who invented a lot of those performance metrics for Governor Bush's administration, and so we have her reservoir of experience to draw on as well. Are there further questions or comments on that point? All right. Let's move on to the program administrator's report. Corey Henderson. Ms. Henderson, you're recognized.
Good afternoon. We have, Dr. Harper and I have had a very busy last few weeks. We have spoken with and met with at least 75% of the entities that make up at least 75% of the pre-applications, including pre-applications that are yet to come that are interested in the process. And as a team, we sat down and reviewed the additional pre-applications that we received through close of business last Friday, the 8th. And before you is the list that, using the same review process with the same criteria, we deemed did not meet eligibility based on the information provided. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Henderson, let me just draw you out a little bit.
Sure.
Can you tell us how many contacts or how many groups you've met with over the course or since our last meeting?
We've met with more than 80 and have a significant number of meetings and also scheduled for next week. So we're booking about 2 weeks out each week.
And have those meetings been with groups and individuals in all of the counties in the Triumph region?
Yes, we have been in all 8 counties. We have been there in person multiple times and will continue to do that. If there's an organization or a local government that feels like they don't have the answers they need to complete their pre-application or their application, pre-application or application at this point, please don't hesitate to reach out to either of us and we'll schedule a conference call. We have found that the calls work almost as well as in person, especially for entities that are newer to the process, because sometimes their questions are more simple. The in-persons tend to be for entities that have more developed projects that are finalizing their applications.
Dr. Dana.
Thank you, Chairman Gates. I just wanted to thank Corey and Rick for what they've been doing in so far over the last month and a half, and just very responsive to the pre-apps and the applicants. And anytime that I place a call to either of them, they are quick to pick up the phone and follow up. And I just really appreciate the work that they've done on behalf of the Triumph.
Mr. Speaker, did you have a comment, sir?
Great job.
Any other comments or questions? I would just like to emphasize the point that directors have made at each of our meetings, and that is, if there is anyone in the Triumph region, anybody in the 8 disproportionately affected counties who has a proposal or an idea for a proposal or a suggestion for an economically transformational project, and you want to discuss this with Triumph Gulf Coast, if you need assistance, if you need to be directed to somebody who can provide you with technical assistance, if you need questions answered, please don't hold that back, but rather contact Susan Skelton, who can triage your concerns, your questions, your ideas to our small but extremely active and highly professional staff to get answers for you and help for you. There, we may make mistakes. We probably will. If so, they'll probably be mine. But one mistake we won't make is slamming the door or being unavailable or being unresponsive to anybody who has an idea, a question, or a project they'd like to discuss with us. You have before you, directors, the report of the program administrator as to the recent pre-apps that have come in, I need a motion to accept that report and the staff recommendations.
Bench moves.
Motion by Speaker Benz. Is there a second? Second by Mr. Connolly. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Does any member object? If not, should it adopt it as presented? Let's move now to the report of our economic advisor, Dr. Rick Harper. Dr. Harper, you're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Corey mentioned, she and I have met with many of the pre-applicants to the Triumph process, and we have received applications from some of those pre-applicants, perhaps not quite as many as we would like to have in hand at this time. We encourage pre-applicants to move towards submitting a fully completed application. At this time, I'd like to speak to some of our conclusions that staff have come to in the process of reviewing the completed applications that we had in hand in time to conduct the beginnings of our due diligence with respect to those applications. There were five of them at the time of the last staff meeting that we had to consider these. Of those, four were in the area of workforce development, career technical education. One was a public infrastructure project. It's the recommendation of staff, and we've worked to implement this, to be in touch with the career technical education proposals, to have further conversations about the type of information that is required to assess the economic contribution of these projects. Specifically, we need information not just that an applicant intends to implement a particular sort of industry-recognized certificate, perhaps automotive, perhaps HVAC, perhaps airframe and power plant, A&P certification, but that we also need to have their best forecast of the likely uptake among the student body of such a program if it is, in fact, put in place, because that will then be the basis for calculating the economic impact of that project and thus being able to come up with the benefit-cost ratio that the directors need as part of their deliberations of the value of the project. And so that might take the form of, if there are 20 students that we can credibly anticipate undertaking and completing the certificate program that we proposed, and that the average increment to wages from obtaining that certificate has been determined by the state's Department of Economic Opportunity, and DEO tracks these dollar figures because they're the ones that receive all of the information about people's unemployment insurance deductions from their paycheck, and they also maintain the databases of which students at which public programs have taken which undertaken which degrees and programs, and thus they are the source, and they in fact calculate this information on an annual basis for the technical schools, the colleges, and the universities. They submit it already to the Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate, and the governor in the form of the economic security report, which you, Mr. Chairman, specified in legislation some years ago. And so that type of information, which would let us calculate the expected increment to wages from completion of a particular program or certification, exists, and it's available from DEO. And then matching that with the number of students expected to go through the program gives us the information that we need to calculate the expected benefit to families in Northwest Florida from that program. And so Corey and I have worked to provide an understanding of the format of the information that's necessary to evaluate the impact of those educational programs. But those four applications, at the time we evaluated them, needed some maturing to come to the stage where we could successfully provide the board with the information it needs to assess the economic value of those programs. The fifth application is from the Port of Panama City. It's a public infrastructure project. As an entity with a long history of having to make the assessment of particular investments on a going-forward basis as to whether it's appropriate to take on debt, to run down reserves, what the expected revenues from a project can be, and how many people might be employed, what their wages are, what their occupations are, they're naturally more easily aware of some of the sorts of numbers that we need to begin the economic calculations to advise and support the board. The Port of Panama City has done those things. They have proposed, they have asked for a $10 million award from Triumph Gulf Coast for activities which include completion of a new 260,000 square foot forest products warehouse, reinforcement of the bulkhead, channel deepening, berth dredging. They currently have a 30-foot depth available. They would like to take that to 36 feet to accommodate the next generation initially of shippers of paper products, where the industry has moved to larger ships. To continue to be competitive, the Port of Panama City needs to provide that greater depth. And the it has a wide range of expected beneficiaries. The initial 330,000-ton increment to capacity made possible by the Eastern Terminal, and the port has purchased 41 acres of commercial property on which they plan to do improvements, are already in the process of doing improvements. They have an option to purchase an additional 27 acres, and combined with the existing capacity at the existing Port of Panama City facilities, which currently handle about 2 million tons of cargo per year, in addition to the initial increment of 330,000 tons envisioned for the Eastern Terminal, which is adjacent to the West Rock paper processing facility, they hope, they expect that over time they will be able to implement, when fully built out, an additional 2 million tons of cargo capacity, essentially doubling the capacity of the Port of Panama City over time to 4 million tons. This is a project that, in looking at the progress of the project, the Port of Panama City has done a good job of attracting tenants to its main port facility that absolutely have need for access, direct access to port facilities. These include firms such as Berg Pipe and Steel, such as Oceaneering, such as the companies that take the timber that is harvested north of in east and west on the old St. Joe timberlands, turned into wood pellets, exported to Europe. And so those are all port tenants. This means that the 110-acre west Port of Panama City is essentially at capacity in terms of accepting new business, and thus the expansion appears to be in line with what's needed to do to attract new private sector entities that have need of shipping and port facilities more generally. So among the advantages that the proposed project has, as we see it, the Eastern Terminal needs development in order to have the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers be assured that it continues to be worthwhile to dredge the channel to 30 feet and then to 36 feet. The Port of Panama City has lined up substantial amounts, particularly of other state funds, but also federal matching funds to complement the money that the Port Authority itself is going to invest, and thus there's a very favorable match. Triumph is only being asked to contribute one out of every $8 that are envisioned for this expansion project. The project has a relatively quick implementation period. It appears that if things go according to plan, that the entire upgrade would be able to be implemented over the 2-year period, ending in late 2019. It has advantages such as the access roads to the new facilities are already designated as part of Florida's strategic intermodal system and thus will be more likely to attract state funding for those upgrades. In beginning a look at the benefit-cost ratios and the calculations, the $10 million project at initial glance is expensive. When we look at the numbers that are envisioned, and like many other ports and public infrastructure users around the state and the nation, the Port of Panama City went to a credible provider of assessments of economic impact. And, of course, you know, we have said to the Triumph pre-applicants that what we need is not a completed study from a national consultant, but instead what we need is a credible explanation of what's the size of the inputs that would be used to such a study, how many direct jobs will be created. In this case, the Port of Panama City is actually a direct employer. They hire the workers at the port. However, it would be perfectly equivalent and absolutely fine if, in fact, they had been a landlord port where independent stevedoring companies and other providers did the direct employment themselves. That would not affect the magnitude of the economic impact. The impact comes from the wages that are paid, the local value added that's created, and then the spin-off effects of those. So what Corey and I have consistently been advising people that we talk to who are pre-applicants is give us what you believe and your narrative should support, and then the performance-based contract would then document as the expectations for the employment creation along with the associated wages that would be created by your project. Tell us that, and that's enough for us to work from, because we can certainly run the standard impact modeling as well as anybody else. And so what we need is a good and thorough description of what the economic contribution is going to be in terms of the job creation, or in the case of education projects, what will be the increment to wages for the students who take these programs, and then let us help do the rest. Well, in doing those numbers and then comparing the such simple metrics as cost per job, which is an appropriate metric, we're looking at a $10 million project. The inputs to the economic impact modeling specify 148 direct jobs created at the port. If you construct a simple ratio, that comes out to be about $68,000. However, that's very expensive relative to the history of Florida incentive programs. I've done some of that, those calculations myself, looking back at the history of Florida job creation incentives. They've tended to be in the $10,000 to $12,000 per job range, both from the time when Dr. Dana served as director of the Office of Trade, Tourism, and Economic Development to the current day, certainly more for headquarters operations. And then manufacturing, because it's a competitive marketplace out there and states are in the business of competing to take that next expansion facility, manufacturing can often command more than that. However, the jobs are somewhat expensive. I certainly have reason to think that the direct job creation may actually be somewhat higher than what the Martin and Associates study has suggested. So, with all that having been said, and the possibility for growth in a critical industry in Northwest Florida, my view is that the possibilities for economic impact of this project, for the possibility of raising family incomes, the statute calls for projects which raise the family income to above the national level, but to get there, you have to hit every step along the way of raising incomes in the area. It's my view that this project does have good potential, and staff would like to request a motion from the board that staff be directed to enter into negotiations with the Port of Panama City with the objective of seeing if the benefit cost ratio could be improved somewhat if there are areas in which the project could economize or look to other sources so that the board can get the very high benefit to cost or, equivalently said, a lower jobs ratio. I should add that if we look at standard measures and standard models for measuring economic impact, port jobs have a very good earnings multiplier. You know, they tend to be high-wage jobs. They tend to have very robust supply chain effects so that there are more people employed supporting a port job than there are in other jobs in other sectors of the economy. When we look at these things, there is the potential for strong economic impact and good benefit cost ratio. So again, with that in mind, the board would like to ask for a motion, staff would like to ask for a motion from the board to enter into negotiations with the intent of arriving at a contract with perhaps a more favorable benefit cost ratio than what we see now that would be appropriate for presenting to the board for their consideration. Ideally, if we can move with all due haste at the next board meeting, but if not, then shortly thereafter.
Let's see if we can get a motion to that effect, and then we'll have discussion. Is there such a motion?
Mr. Speaker?
Mr. Connolly.
I'm going to be happy to make the motion on this one. I would like to just make a comment or two.
Of course, please.
Before I do so. I think this is a good project to come out of the gate with, Dr. Harper. There's a lot of good applications I'm seeing forthcoming. I think this one does fit much of what we've talked about for the last 2 years. It could be very transformational. I think it focuses on a sector of our economy that, if improved, further diversifies our economy. I like the fact that we've got something in front of us that has such an attractive private investment match. We've talked about that time and again as well. I mean, at the current numbers, it's at least 5-1. You mentioned an 8-1, I think, in another comment. I don't yet think we're at the level we want to be on a price per job. I think that would be part of the authority we're asking for you and the rest of staff to go work on. And then I would anticipate, and maybe I'll put this in the form of a question, if I can have him answer before I make the motion. You would bring us some sort of term sheet that we could review that is almost fully baked contractually, and then that would be our next step to approve that term sheet and contract. Is that what you would anticipate being the next piece this board would do?
Dr. Harper and Mr. Remington, can you both comment on that?
Yes, and looking at my notes, Director Connolly, I see you're correct. I see I'd made a notation of $1 out of every six as opposed to $1 out of every eight. Thank you. Yes, that's the sort of thing that we would anticipate doing, working with the applicant to see if there are areas where we can improve that benefit-cost ratio to get it to something that more closely approximates the state average, understanding, of course, that these jobs are highly coveted by states, and they do command a higher-than-average premium for the agencies which are funding them via incentives.
Mr. Remington, what's the work product that we would likely see from you and Dr. Harper, assuming the board authorizes staff to proceed with negotiating?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe what would happen is that Dr. Harper and Ms. Henderson would start working on a term sheet with this applicant, and we would anticipate coming back to the board at a meeting with a term sheet for review and approval. And then if the term sheet were approved, it would essentially start the template for a contract, but we don't anticipate coming back with a fully vetted negotiated contract until we have a term sheet agreed to.
Okay. That answers my question. Happy to make the motion when you're ready.
Okay, Mr. Connolly, you're recognized.
Sure, I'd be happy to make the motion that we authorize staff as requested and legal counsel, I'd add, to perform the necessary due diligence, the cost-benefit analysis that goes with that. Any other economic tests, Dr. Harper, that we need to include in that as appropriate, and then to negotiate that contract and bring us back that term sheet for consideration hopefully at our next time we come together.
Is there a second? Is there a second?
So moved.
Seconded by Speaker Benz. All right, is there a discussion on the motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker.
I would like to just say a little bit about the port. It's in my hometown, clearly. You know, Ronald Reagan had a great saying when he talked about America being the shining city upon a hill. It was a great saying because America is a shining city upon a hill. I can tell you that the Port of Panama City, with respect to Panama City, is a shining city upon a hill. The leaders are well-respected. The board members are well-respected. They have done a great job of expanding the port, managing it in a very, very frugal manner. The new port that they're going to open up, number one, the existing port is full, and the existing tenants want to expand. We have an opportunity, I'm talking about we, the port in Panama City has an opportunity to expand to the east. It will be great. And I will tell you, the area to the east where they're expanding to is a I grew up in that part of town. It's a rough part of town. Right, William? It's a rough part of town. I played baseball 100 yards from the mill and 55 years ago, and I can tell you, on a smoggy, foggy night, you couldn't see the pitcher if you were the catcher because there was a little pollution there. Now, they've cleaned it up. The mill's fine now. It's very fine. But I do think this will add stability to the paper mill to stay there. They employ a lot of people in our world. But, again, I think you've got great management at the port. They're going to be able to expand the port, bring in new ships. I think there's a reasonable chance that we'll hear in the next week or 10 days about some federal money to expand and deepen the port in that area. So I think this is a great one for us to come out of the gate with. I really do.
Further comments? Further comments?
Yeah, I'll just say something real
quick.
Yes, sir,
Mr. Riggs.
I've had the privilege of meeting with the port, and, you know, in short, they have their act together. They know who they are. They know where they're going. There's a plan. From a business perspective, I like them because they run the port like a business, not a quasi-governmental entity. Dr. Rick Harper in his report has even mentioned that they've committed all their available cash and taken on additional debt to be able to get some of these things done. But if we end up, moving forward with this project, this is going to help the port also generate additional fees to help be self-sustaining. So this is, sustainability is one thing that we've talked about. This is not something that they're going to create, and then it's going to be this black hole of, where's the next money going to come from? This is going to generate additional fees. And then going back to Dr. Rick Harper's point, the earnings multiplier on a port is higher than some other opportunities that we may have. So even though the direct jobs may not have the exact multiplier we would like, the earnings multiplier on the auxiliary businesses that spin off from this are going to be good. So I'm in favor of this project.
Further comments? Dr. Dana.
Thank you, Chairman Gates. One thing that I don't think was emphasized enough in the presentation on the port was that while the expansion and improvements will lead to creating new jobs and opportunities, it'll also lend to retention of those companies that are at the port. I think without the kind of infrastructural enhancements that are being proposed, if they aren't done, the port would stand the risk of losing those companies to other ports that are more modernized. So I just want to make that point. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Any further comments? Any further comments? Do you understand the motion before you? Would you like to? I'm sorry, Mr. Lee, did you wish to comment?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
But not at all.
I did want to weigh in. This project is in my backyard as well, and I echo Speaker Brent's comments on the port. There's no better operated organization in our community. It really opens up. This project is considered a Bay County project, I guess, from all standpoints, but this is a regional project. There's no question here. This port has opportunities throughout our entire region as well as north of us, and if you look north of Panama City, there's a lot of pine trees, and there's a lot of families that depend on agriculture, and this port has embraced that and helped those families, and I think that from a standpoint of sustaining industry that we have in Panama City. It is an excellent opportunity for us to be able to do that. And, you know, they're not coming to us asking for the whole amount. I think 16% is what they're asking for, and I think it's a great way for us to start off with this project.
Mr. Shelf, any comments? Do you understand the motion? Would you like the motion restated? Mr. Connolly, would you restate the motion, please?
So I move we authorize. Button matters, doesn't it? Recommend we authorize staff and legal counsel to work together to perform the necessary due diligence that's forthcoming, to do the cost-benefit analysis, run the economic tests, and as appropriate, go ahead and begin negotiations on a performance contract in hopes that we'll have that term sheet in front of us next time we're together.
Is there any debate? Is there any discussion? If not, because this is the first step that we're taking toward the award of a major transformational project, I'd like to have a recorded vote on this matter. And so would the executive director please call the roll on the motion by Mr. Connolly?
Mr. Bentz?
Yes.
Mr. Connolly?
Yes.
Dr. Dana?
Yes.
Chair Gates?
Yes.
Mr. Lee?
Yes.
Mr. Riggs?
Yes.
Mr. Schoaf?
Yes.
Unanimous vote, Mr. Chair.
By our action, the motion is adopted. And we have in our audience this morning the executive director of the port, Mr. Wayne Stubbs. Mr. Stubbs, if you'd like to share any comments.
I'd be quiet if I were you, buddy. You just won.
Yeah. All you can do now is get yourself in trouble. Mr. Stubbs.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, I do want to say that just very, very briefly, I want to thank all of you for the hard work you've put in and for your willingness to look at our application closely. I appreciate your staff going over it so thoroughly. I know that a lot of you have had the time to come and visit the East Terminal project. And I just want to say I think this is a historical project. It's the most important thing the Port of Panama City has done in over 50 years. And I think if you stop to think that the reason we have International Paper initially, West Rock Paper Mill there, Berg Steel Pike, Oceaneering, and Viva in our region, it's because they needed port facilities and we were able to provide them. And considering that we are at capacity or nearing capacity right now, the East Terminal Project is going to give us the opportunity to keep providing port facilities for companies to come in the decades ahead. And I think that's going to be very, very important. It's while it's important, it's also, in terms of cost, four times more than anything our Port Authority has ever tried to handle. And the initial startup of a brand-new deep-water facility is very, very expensive. And so I just want to say if we didn't need the help with this project, we wouldn't be asking for it. At the same time, we know there are a lot of other deserving applicants, and we do appreciate that you have tough decisions to make. But if you are able to help us with this, it's going to be very, very timely. It's going to allow us to keep moving forward without being weighed down with too much debt. And I think it's going to be very good for the region. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir. Members, with your permission, certainly take any criticism of this. And if you want to do it a different way, we will. As we get to a point of developing term sheets on projects, I'd like to ask if we could have a board liaison, a board member, who would provide advice and consultation to the professional staff in developing, in doing negotiation if necessary, or developing a term sheet, critiquing our staff work, so that we have the sense of the board. And we can take advantage of the expertise that we have on this board. As Speaker Benz has pointed out before, we have, with one exception, me, we have an extraordinary amount of business experience and skill on this board, and therefore we want to be able to apply it. So would members have any objection if I asked Dr. Dana if she would serve as board liaison in the development of this presentation of this project to the board and a term sheet and contract? Would there be an objection to that?
Brilliant move.
Dr. Dana, would you accept that role, please?
I'd be honored. Thank you for asking.
And that's a practice that I'd like to use as we go forward as appropriate. There may be some where it's not necessary, but maybe some where it is appropriate. And in this case, I think particularly with Dr. Dana's background as Governor Bush's economic development director and her extensive knowledge of Florida sports, I think this will work out well. So, Dr. Dana, with the board's concurrence, you're appointed. And now I'd like to move on.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Couple
Mr. Speaker.
Comments. Number one, I would remind everyone that our first board meeting was July 15th, something like that, Susan, mid-July. 8 months later, we're awarding $10 million. That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Up to, Mr. Connolly says.
Now, he wanted $10 million by December 31st, Mr. Connolly did. He's a young guy. He doesn't understand that. You have to take your time and things like that. But I think that's great leadership, Mr. Chairman. The second thing is I did give Ronald Reagan credit for the term shining city upon a hill. He actually stole it from President Kennedy, who I frankly respected, who stole it from Governor Winthrop, who was the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Whatever.
Well, there you go. Aren't you glad you came? You've got that information. If there's nothing else at the moment on the Port Panama City project, let's move on to Dr. Harper's second part of your report having to do with any process recommendations that you might have as we move forward.
Yes, as Ms. Henderson and I have visited with applicants, we have several suggestions as to the nature of our process and what we might do to streamline it, make it easier for applicants, and take a step farther towards giving the board the information that it needs. And I'd ask Corey to comment on those things.
Thank you. We recognize through our conversations, and we really do appreciate the feedback, that there are some changes that could be made to both the pre-application and the application to simplify the process, because so many pre-applicants have indicated that their application is likely to come in April or May. We're not going to touch the application at this time, rest assured. But we would like to go ahead and make some tweaks to the pre-application to make it more user-friendly on both sides of the process. It would allow applicants. What we found a lot was if applicants went a little bit further, they're spending so much time on the pre-application that they almost had half the application filled out. And so we'd like to try to find ways to make the pre-application more of a pre-application and not such a rigorous process.
Dr. Dana, I know that you were involved in sort of setting up how we would at least initially approach the interests that we had from people throughout the region. Does this make sense to you? Do you have any comment?
Thank you, Chairman Gates. I think it makes a lot of sense. In fact, when we set forth with the pre-application and the application itself, we modeled the application after the Florida Job Fund program. I'm probably saying it wrong, but the one that Enterprise Florida and Department of Economic Opportunity currently operate in Tallahassee. So the application's very close to that one. However, the pre-apps we developed in the meanwhile on our own, what we did agree to is as we deployed that pre-application, if we saw that we could refine it, we left ourselves the latitude to revisit the pre-application and application so that we could make this process as seamless as possible. So I appreciate that you guys are, you guys being Corey and Rick, are hearing from the region and listening to those critiques. And I'm assuming that you would come back to us. How do you propose making these refinements?
We can share a draft. Susan can distribute a draft, and then we'll go from there.
But as going forward from this point, unless there's a suggestion from the board as to how we would proceed differently, if I'm in the audience today or if I'm concerned about a project that I might have an interest in, how will your suggestion change what I do?
We will still accept the original draft. We're not going to put more work on each of the pre-applicants. We would just encourage you in about 2 weeks to check back if you haven't actually submitted one yet and find an easier to work with version.
Okay. And how many applications, full applications, have we received? Is it six?
No, we've received about three or four more this week in addition to the 11, I believe that we have. I think we have around 15 full applications.
About 15 at the moment? Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we've received a lot of feedback that many will be going before county commissions and city councils in April for final approval and that we would be receiving them after those votes take place.
All right. Very good. Any comment or objection to these refinements? If not, before we move on from Dr. Harper and Ms. Henderson's report, are there any board questions or comments or criticisms about how we're proceeding in working with applicants or interested parties?
Mr. Chairman, do we need a motion to approve those recommendations?
Yes, sir, if you'd like.
Sure.
There's a motion to approve staff's recommendations as to refining the application process. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Lee. Is there discussion? Is there debate? Is there objection? Does any member object? If not, show it adopted. And now, any further comments about the application process, about how we're working with interested parties, any criticisms or suggestions for how we can do our job better? If not, yes, sir.
I'll just quickly comment and thank the staff for what you brought for us today. The work you've had to put into the last few weeks to get ready for one approval has been monumental. I do like the trajectory we're on, Mr. Chairman, of giving them the authority to take what we think is a really good project, go negotiate it to get the best bang for our buck out of it, not necessarily at the applied-for grant dollar. But I think we find good projects, and we can move them forward in this way. And I like the method we're employing today on this first one. I'm sure we'll tweak it, but I wanted to compliment you in guiding the staff on getting us here today because I do think this is a good trajectory for us to be on.
Thank you. Dr. Dana?
No, I agree.
Any other comments, criticisms, suggestions? If not, Dr. Harper, Ms. Henderson, any other comment from you at this point?
No, sir.
All right. Thank you very much for your good work.
Thank you.
Ms. Skelton, may I turn to you, please, for a recommendation that I think piggybacks onto Dr. Harper's previous report and discussion about career technical education and the need to begin getting some subject area analysis. Ms. Skelton.
Yes, sir. As Dr. Harper discussed, in the original four workforce applications that came in that staff looked at, there were some issues where we weren't sure that the applicants were understanding the outcome information that is needed to run the modeling. And we feel like we need to think about at this point what an expert in the education performance field would be able to help us with in meeting those criteria as these applications come in, and also to be able to look at the applications on the from our side of the coin and understand what performance measures could be recommended to be built into these workforce projects. And so in having that conversation with Dr. Harper and the chair, we're at the point, I believe, where I would like to ask the board to consider a motion to allow me to begin to hire experts, subject matter experts, as needed on a per occurrence basis to deal with the pre-applications or applications as they're coming in for review and also for assistance with creating the appropriate performance measures. And again, we wouldn't need to do this on all applications, but if there's a particular subject that requires a little bit more refined understanding, we'd like to be able to locate the expert and come in and do that. And we could do that within the budget that the board has already approved for this for the annual operating budget. And the line on that was $100,000.
Other questions? Yes, sir. Mr. Connolly.
Would you envision putting them on some sort of retainer so that you can draw on them as needed, or do you have a model that you're really seeking to employ here?
I think in the first instance, we're looking at a per-occurrence cost. There are four applications. We're probably in the range of $1,500 to $2,500 per occurrence. We don't know how much of this we'll need, and we'd like to keep the cost as low as we can. And rather than having someone on retainer, we think we'd like to be able to reach out per instance if that's the feeling of the board.
Okay. I can support that.
Further questions or comments? We need a motion for that, I think. Is there a motion? Is there a motion to approve the executive director's recommendation?
I'll move it.
Moved by Mr. Connolly. Is there
second.
A second? Second by Dr. Benz. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Does any member object? Show it adopted. Before we go much further.
When did I get my PhD? I didn't know I had a PhD. You say Dr. Benz?
Dr. Benz. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, sir.
Hey, I'll take it, man. I need it.
Well, you deserve it. You deserve it.
Dr. Data.
We, at the conclusion of the meeting, we always take public comment from any member of the public who wants to share with us any observations they have. We have a sheet now, which we have some people who've signed up. But if you do want to comment, if you do want to share your thoughts with the board on any subject that relates to our work, here is the sheet. And you can see Ms. Skelton over there at the end of the dais, and she will add you to the list, and we will call on you, because we certainly want to hear from you if you have any thoughts for us. Mr. Remington, let's go to your legal report, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two matters to bring up with the board today. First, involving an adjustment to the Articles of Incorporation with respect to our 501c3 application. You will recall at our December meeting in Bay County, there was a discussion regarding our application with the IRS for recognition as a tax-exempt organization. At that meeting, it was discussed and announced that we would be filing under Section 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code. However, there was not a formal motion or vote to that effect. In order to clean up the records of the corporation, I'd like to ask for a motion from the board to ratify and confirm the decision to apply for tax-free status under Section 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code, and authorize Chairman Gates to execute any amended Articles of Incorporation or other documents necessary or required to memorialize this action.
Mr. Riggs?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Dr. Dana. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Does any member object? Show it adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secondly, an information item. On January 18th of this year, we sent a letter to Senate President Negron and Speaker Richard Corcoran asking for any guidance or clarification they could offer with respect to the legislative intent of the Triumph statute, specifically in regard to consideration of applications from private entities. Since our last meeting, we have received three responses to this letter, one from the Senate, one from a delegation of House representatives, and one from a private party. Those letters have been provided to the members and staff, and at this time we're taking them under advisement. The letters will also be posted to our website.
All right.
At this time, there's no action for the board to take.
Mr. Chairman, I think that clearly this is a very important issue, and I don't know where members are on this issue. Clearly haven't talked. But I think it's a little bit for us an elephant in the room, and I think we need to deal with it as soon as we can. We can chat about it today, or I would let's get ourselves on the clock. You know, in 30 days at the next board meeting, let's determine if we are going to advance dollars to private sector entities, either for improvements or whatever. But let's figure out where we are. We've gotten feedback from the legislature. We've gotten feedback from our attorney. And I know there are a lot of folks out there that are wondering, what are we going to do? So it's kind of one of those, let's go up or down. I mean, let's, you know, if we decide today or if we decide next month what we want to do, then I'm all in. So, but I do think that it, in my world, anxiety is very distressing to me. I want an answer, yes or no. Then I can deal with it, you know. Mm-hmm. I can then deal with my problem, whatever the issue is. So I would, and I'll follow your guidance, Mr. Chairman, but I do think we need to come up with a decision of where we are on this specific issue, because it's going to keep going.
Any board comments on this matter now? If not, we can certainly put it on the agenda for a future meeting to have a discussion about it. Any other comments from anyone? All right. If not, it'll certainly be on a future agenda. Thank you.
If we could do it in April, that would be good, or a future, to your chairman or whatever, but let's move on.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything else, Mr. Arrington?
No, sir. That concludes my report.
Any questions for our legal counsel? If not, let's move to public comment. Ms. Skelton, do we have some additional players? Alan Pierce from Franklin County. Mr. Pierce, thank you for being here, and we welcome you. We appreciate your input. You're recognized.
Thank you. I just want to make a clarification to the letter we submitted to the board, to you all, I'm sorry. On March 6th, the County Commission adopted a letter advising that we were going to put a cap of $2 million on the first round of applications coming out of Franklin County. That was done in the spirit of partnership with you all because we didn't know how fast you were going to proceed on reviewing applications. We knew there were more applications coming out of Franklin County in the pipeline, so we didn't want to mislead you all to think that what we had in the pot was all that may come out, and we just want to make sure you all are aware that we're working on other things, and we also hadn't seen what the school board was going to submit at the time. So I consider this letter as guidance for you all. It's not definitive at this point, but it's something that we're all trying to work together on so we all can get the most bang for our buck in Franklin County.
Thank you very, very much. Yes. We appreciate your interest, and thanks for being here.
And you all are doing a great job, and we look forward to getting our project approved also.
And depending upon whether we approve it and how we approve it, you'll tell us whether we're still doing a great job.
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Kristen Wagley, please, from the Gulf Restoration Network. You're recognized, sir. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for. I've missed your last couple of meetings with newer to the east, so thanks for being back in my neck of the woods, as they say. I do have a letter for each board member. Shall I bring that to the chairman, or
just give it to Ms. Skelton, and she'll distribute it?
I will do that on my way out. Thank you. Again, I work for the Gulf Restoration Network. We're a 501c3 nonprofit based in New Orleans, but I am based in Pensacola, and I cover the panhandle from Perdido Bay all the way east to Apalachicola Bay. We work on a variety of environmental issues, but real focus of ours is water quality in our bays and bayous, and we're dedicated to a healthy and restored Gulf of Mexico, and knowing that if our bays and bayous that feed the Gulf are not healthy, then the Gulf itself cannot be healthy. So a couple of things, just a couple of points I wanted to mention. Obviously, the enabling legislation or the legislation that guides your work does not allow you to give money directly to individual businesses and companies. So one of the eligible expenses after that then is clearly going to be public infrastructure, and I know we're seeing some applications along those lines. So another point I wanted to make is that in your legislation that guides your work, there's also a series of points that are made about projects and programs that you can prioritize or should prioritize, and one of those is projects that benefit the environment in addition to the economy. And so I wanted to mention to you there are a number of infrastructure needs throughout Panhandle communities that kind of bring those two things together. One of them that we're working on is sewage and wastewater issues, and there are a lot of communities that are struggling with that. We're having sewage overflows in some of the older areas of some of our Panhandle communities. Sewage expansion can be done strategically where it enables a business to expand or a new area to develop and revitalize. It may not otherwise be able to happen if that expansion is not made. So you combine that environmental and economic benefit together. Another thing I remind you that I probably need to remind anybody, we get 63 inches of rain a year. We're one of the wettest parts of America. We have major stormwater pollution and flooding issues. And so stormwater projects are another thing that can be done strategically. It's public infrastructure, but it can be done in a way that incentivizes nearby development. And I'll give you a quick example. In Pensacola, the city's been really good about a couple of stormwater. They're parks now. They're urban amenities. They're parks where people go that also serve a stormwater need. And one of them in particular allows an upstream area a couple of blocks away to develop and build out completely, and they send their stormwater a couple of blocks away. So that project has allowed a new parcel of land to be developed and revitalized. So I just wanted to leave you with that and ask you as you further refine and develop the criteria you're using in judging these projects that you look at those public infrastructure projects that also provide an environmental benefit. And thank you all for your service.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. And I apologize for not being able to read this very well, but I think it's Carol Tabay. Is that right? From the Audubon Society.
I noticed that you put a lot of thought into the economic impacts of the projects, and I was just wondering if there's any possibility that thought could be put into the environmental impacts of the projects that come before you. A healthy environment's going to make the whole Gulf Coast triumph. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Keith Wilkins from the City of Pensacola. Mr. Wilkins.
Thank you very much. Keith Wilkins, Assistant City Administrator for City of Pensacola. First off, I would like to congratulate the Port of Panama City. They've done a terrific job down there with their growth and expansion and the management of that facility, and it's the envy of every other city with a port. So congratulations, and also congratulations to the board for the first one out of the gates and the hard work that you and your staff have done. I would just like to mention, and I have some brochures that I'll provide to Ms. Skelton for each of you, but we submitted yesterday afternoon our Pensacola International Airport MRO expansion facility application. And that project, we're very proud of that project. We think it is truly transformational, as most everyone does who's standing where I'm standing right now feel about their projects. But just in the last couple of weeks, we were awarded a $4 million grant from the Florida Job Growth Fund. We were yesterday received a commitment letter from a private partner for $35 million towards this project. And today we've announced that the legislature has allocated an additional $3 million for this project. So we do feel like it has good legs, has great opportunity, and the full application was submitted yesterday to your staff. So thank you very much for your consideration of that and for your good work.
Thank you very much, sir. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to speak to the board? Is there anyone else? Well, if not, we want to thank all of you for attending today and ask board members if they have any final comments or direction or criticism or helpful suggestions. Mr. Schoaf? Mr. Speaker?
Great leadership.
Mr. Riggs? Mr. Connolly? Dr. Dana? Mr. Lee? I would only offer one comment. I went back in reviewing minutes. There was a comment made by Mr. Connolly a couple of meetings ago that I want to associate myself with as we go forward now to look at these workforce education projects that are next in the pipeline to be evaluated. And ask Mr. Connolly if you want to correct me if I misunderstood his comments, but what I took to be his suggestion was that we have a regional view, a regional outlook on workforce education and not have a parochial outlook where we have duplicative projects next to each other or where we have projects that are taken in isolation without a view towards the workforce needs of the whole region. And Mr. Connolly, I want to just ask if you could want to comment on that, because I want to make sure that we, if we are of one mind about this as we move forward.
Sure, I'm happy to. Thank you for bringing it back up. So I recall the conversation, I think it was in Bay County, and it was in the midst of us looking at the first sets of pre-applications, and I saw a number of workforce development applications, some of which in part felt duplicative to me as I read through them. And rather than us be duplicative in many communities across the region, my suggestion was we just step back and be sure that whatever we look at from a workforce development perspective supports a workforce development strategy for our region and is not duplicative in so many ways that we're not putting our money where we should. For instance, if we don't need multiple welding programs in the same community. I think we need to be thoughtful about having one that's the most effective it can be to support local workforce. So that's the spirit in which I was referring.
Well, I would just encourage Ms. Skelton and professional staff to take a regional view as to the workforce needs of the area. People drive back and forth to work. They drive back and forth across the Pensacola Bay Bridge between two counties. They drive back and forth between Bay and Walton and Okaloosa County, and they drive back and forth in McCulloch County and Gulf County and Franklin County to work. County lines are imaginary lines created by politicians, and are, you know, people go back and forth to church, to trade, to play ball, to do all kinds of other things, and certainly to go to a job. So let's look for regional solutions that make sense when we step back and look at our whole region.
And, Mr. Chairman, I echo, I think that's a great idea. No disrespect to staff, but maybe that's an expert that we can bring in that we talked about earlier, someone who focuses on education and workforce that could assist staff. No, again, no disrespect to staff, but that might be a good first step there.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, Mr. Schoaf moves your eyes.